an undercurrent of it, actually, despite all the fun I was having, was a fear that I'd never find my path in life. I knew all the things I didn't want to do, all the maps that had been laid out for me by my school and my teachers and my parents didn't suit me. But I had no idea what I was going to do.
I'm Michael Max, and this is Geological. Generosity has been on my mind, and it's something I'd rather not think about. It worries me. It disturbs me. Often, when the conversation turns toward generosity, I want to change the subject. I want to change the subject because it makes me uncomfortable. It seems what is about to ensue is some kind of honor competition, and I brace for some humble bragging that's going to make me feel agitated. I'm afraid that I'm not going to measure up, and I'm going to be seen as selfish and self-serving. That I'm going to fall short. It will be clear to all that I don't have enough because, well, if I did, then I'd be more generous. Generosity has too many hidden landmines. Having a conversation about it, for me, it's like trying to have a relationship with someone who will not face their shadows and traumas. There's just too many times I'm going to trip a trigger. I have trouble with discussions on generosity, partly because I think the term is ill-defined. We think we know what we're talking about, but I suspect if we sat down and asked a dozen people to define generosity, we just might surprisingly discover that we're not all talking about the same thing. When I think of generosity, a few things come to mind. Having enough, so I've got the ability to give to others, or not having enough, but giving to others anyway, or fear of receiving from others because it puts me in the one down position of having received. Or sometimes I think of it as a competitive way of demonstrating value or worth. There is implicit status in being, air quotes here, generous. It puts you in the one-up position. This power dynamic always makes me edgy. It's often used for manipulation. We see this principle of reciprocity, where someone will give you something, knowing full well that you'll be obligated to give something back in some way. Sneaky salespeople do this all the time. Whole internet empires have been built on freemium as a way to get you to use the service. It's easy to mistake free with generous, and that will lead you into a world of hurt, or Facebook. There is a lot we could discuss about generosity, and you'll likely hear me touch back on this again in the near future, as it deeply has my attention at this moment in time. Marketing mensch Seth Godin says, "Generosity is not about lowering your prices. It's about doing the hard emotional work of creating something of value." Jewish culture holds that there are various levels of giving and generosity, the lowest form being where both the giver and the receiver are aware of each other in the exchange, the middle level being where the giver knows who is received, but the receiver doesn't know who the giver is. And then there's the highest level of generosity, where neither the giver nor the receiver are aware of each other. Today, I'll just leave you with the question, what do you think about generosity? What comes to mind? You can send me a message from the website. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. In a moment, we'll be getting into a conversation on Yangsheng, the nourishment of life, with Peter Dedman. It's impossible to be within the world of Chinese medicine and not have heard of Peter's name. He's contributed so much to our profession over the years and is such a good example of how service can drive entrepreneurship. We've got two short practice-changing classes coming up this weekend. For you Moxa aficionados, on January 23rd, we'll have an hour-and-a-half presentation from Oren Kaviti that focuses on Harada Zone therapy using the Ontake warm bamboo method. If you love Moxa and you love hands-on work, you're not going to want to miss this one. Additionally, there's a special PDF of the first three chapters of his new upcoming book for attendees of this course. On Sunday, the 24th, Toby Daly will be talking about reading the nonverbal facial signals of complexion and expression as a way to determine how your patient is responding to treatment. If you've worked with some acupuncture or thinking about doing so, this hour-plus discussion will be helpful in understanding key things to look for so you can be confident that your diagnosis and treatment are correct. Visit the website to sign up for either of these helpful clinical discussions. Real Mushrooms is the sponsor of today's show. Why is reishi known as the mushroom of longevity? In many cultures, mushrooms are considered nourishing to the spirit. Reishi, or lingzhi in Chinese, can be translated as spirit mushroom. It has long been associated with longevity, spiritual clarity, and robust health. So, why are all of these associated with reishi? More on that later in the show. Over the years, I've come to have deep respect for those entrepreneurs who saw something that our world needed and stepped up to fill that gap. Let's get into this conversation with Peter Dedman. Peter Dedman, welcome to Geological.
It's good to be here.
So, I don't think there's anyone who has studied acupuncture that isn't familiar with the name Dedman, because it's all over the acupuncture books. Actually, when I was in school, that book was just coming out. We were very excited about it.
Well, it is a bit of a paradox to have a surname like Dedman in the field of health, but, you know, I'm used to it.
I know, it's kind of a pirate name, isn't it?
You know, there's a really interesting potential origin of this name. There's a conventional one. It's just a derivation of an old English place name. But more interesting one is that it comes from a word called Dodman, which was the name for an early surveyor who held two sticks. We've got a famous chalk carving in the south of England of a male figure holding two long sticks. These were thought to trace ley lines over hills when they wanted to connect places from one side to the other side of the hill. They'd use the sticks. So a Dodman was a primitive, almost an earth acupuncturist, actually.
Yes. Tracking the meridians of the earth.
Exactly. That's my preferred explanation. Yeah.
I kind of like the pirate name myself.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the pirates are actually, the pirates are quite interesting. They're actually a very democratic crowd. I mean, you know, there's all the, you know, things that we see in Hollywood about, you know, these, you know, vicious, rapacious characters, but a lot of them were just looking to make a living, you know, just a little bit outside the law. They were sort of the black marketeers. They were looking at markets, and they were fiercely democratic, and they shared in the take.
It's good to know.
Cool stuff. We had an exhibit here in St. Louis a few years ago that went into that. It was quite
well, curious. Like the word terrorist, you know, it depends who's defining it.
That's right.
I mean, you know, the British Navy were pirates. They used to attack and steal from foreign ships, but of course they never considered themselves to be pirates. So.
No, they were flying under the, you know, Union Jack, so they were not pirates.
Exactly.
Unless somebody was getting their ship looted, in which case, those damn British pirates.
Indeed, yeah.
Anyway, you have been a longtime entrepreneur. Long time. I remember in a previous conversation we had, I think you were working in like Whole Foods and health foods and then into Chinese medicine. You've given us the Journal of Chinese Medicine, you know, all the books that you've done. Where does your inspiration come from for doing these kinds of things, this kind of work?
That's a big question, obviously. Actually, entrepreneur, I am an entrepreneur, it's true, but many people would think of the definition of an entrepreneur as somebody who is primarily out to make money. Whereas I think
that definition is wrong.
Yeah, I don't feel like that at all. Mm-hmm. I've always purely and utterly followed my enthusiasms and my interests. And luckily, most of them have been successful. Not all of them, but so in that sense, I'm an entrepreneur. It's funny, I've just been writing my memoirs, so soon to be published. And, you know, it's quite interesting looking back to see the kind of pattern and arc to life. So I was brought up in a very radical family, an anti-establishment, socialist, even communist family, actually. So I never basically accepted the idea of the status quo. I was always encouraged to challenge the status quo.
You were a pirate.
I was a pirate, indeed. And then I was at that particular age, you know, when the 60s came along and the kind of revolution of the 60s, the turnaround and cultural revolution of the 60s. I went to an exhibition in London a couple of years ago called Talking About Revolution, which was a history of the radical movements of the 60s. And even though I lived through them, I was astonished how radical they were. They were far, far more radical than anything that's going on now. And it was a period of time that gave rise to feminism, environmentalism, black rights, the rise of the British working class into popular culture, epitomized by people like the Beatles and so on. You know, everything was an upheaval. I think there was also what went with that, there was a lot of interest in different cultures, particularly Far Eastern cultures.
Yeah.
Seemed to be part of the gestalt of the time. So those were good reasons for me to orientate myself differently, perhaps. And then I spent a few very kind of wild, adventurous, fun, rather decadent years doing lots of traveling.
Which is a good thing to do when you're young.
Great. It was great.
Chinese say you will kai yin jia, right? It'll open your world eyes.
Yeah.
There's no other education quite like that.
I absolutely agree. And it was a great time to travel. I mean, this was before mass tourism. You know, I was so lucky. Even a few years later, the experience would have been different. You know, I could travel down through Spain to places that are now massive tourist spots, and they were just little fishing villages then. So, you know, it was special. But the end result of that rather reckless living was I got sick. I got a bad case of hepatitis. And I kind of reached the end of that period of my life. An undercurrent of it, actually, despite all the fun I was having, was a fear that I'd never find my path in life. I knew all the things I didn't want to do, all the maps that had been laid out for me by my school and my teachers and my parents didn't suit me, but I had no idea what I was going to do. So it was always this kind of mild anxiety underneath all this. When I got sick, very sick actually, I discovered macrobiotics, which was I don't know if you're familiar with it, but Zen macrobiotics was a, macrobiotics means big life. So it was an approach to diet based on Japanese traditional medicine. It was the movement that brought brown rice and miso and seaweeds and natural foods to the West, really. Or it was one of the moves.
I'm remembering that now.
Yeah. As far as Britain was concerned, one part of that natural food movement came from China, from the British Raj. But this came from, you know, further east, from Japan, and it was based on yin-yang. So I really got into that kind of thinking, and I discovered my first aim or purpose, which was to set up first a natural food macrobiotic restaurant, and then a shop selling foods, organic and natural foods, in 1971, so very much ahead of its time, which meant a real economic struggle. You know, sometimes we had 5 customers a day, but, you know.
You were on the cutting edge.
Cutting edge, yeah. So it was a bit of a struggle. And we set up a bakery and we set up a warehouse. That business is still going. When I quit, soon after I quit, we set it up as a workers' cooperative and donated the business to the co-op. So now it's a pretty big operation. It employs about 150 people and ships natural foods all over the United Kingdom, big mover in the organic food scene. I did that for a few years, and then I got to a point where I, for all the challenge, and it was, you know, the fun, it was a hippie thing, really, you know. So it was good fun always. Hard, very, very hard work.
Yes, hard work.
But we played at it as well.
Mm-hmm. You could really put your heart into it.
It was heart and sweat.
Mm-hmm. Well, wait, isn't sweat the fluid of the heart? Isn't that what we say in Chinese medicine?
Yes, I think we do, don't we?
I think we do.
Yes, that's a good point. got to the point where I realized I didn't want to be a shopkeeper for the rest of my life. And I went through a period, which has happened to me a few times, of uncertainty, where I knew I had to give up something, but I wasn't sure what was going to come next. And I've learned to embrace that feeling of being at sea without a, without an anchor for a while, to create the space. You know, one thing, I do a lot of Qigong, and I'm very interested in the idea that when we create space in the body, Qi arises in the empty space. It's a bit like that. We allow ourselves to be uncertain in the faith, in the hope that something will stir and rise up from the depths. That's how it's happened for me. It's never been a kind of thought process or an intellectual process. It's hit me from below, if you like. And that was acupuncture. I'll be an acupuncturist. Because through macrobiotics, I'd encountered Japanese shiatsu, and I'd started to learn the meridians a bit and some of the points for massage and so on. So that's what set me on the path.
It's amazing to me how I don't think we throw anything away in our life. We can go from season to season in our life. We can go from one thing to another. But whatever path we walk, it stays with us in a certain way. You know, I hear you talk about that you didn't know what you wanted to do, but you certainly knew what you didn't want to do. And man, that rings a bell for me. I'm cut from that same cloth.
Yeah.
And in some ways, that's really hard, especially when it looks like everybody around you knows what they're doing. And it's hard when society says, here's a path that works for everybody else. How come it's not working for you? What's wrong with you, pal?
Yep.
And the thing about being an entrepreneur, it's funny, I did a lot of work with my hands when I was younger. I worked in arts and crafts. I did some glass blowing. And it, much to the chagrin of my family, because they wanted me to work with my head, not my hands. But I remember like eking out a living as a hippie glass blower. And my grandmother, what she would tell her friends is, oh, my grandson, I'm so proud of him. He's an entrepreneur. And at that moment in my life, I hated it. I was like, no, I'm not. But here's what I discovered about being an entrepreneur. First of all, if you want to make money, if you're actually interested in making money, and that's your main goal, don't be an entrepreneur. It's a really bad idea, because over 80% of entrepreneurial enterprises, they fail.
Yep.
Most entrepreneurs don't do it for the money. You look at any really brilliant entrepreneur, they're doing it because it's something they love. It's something they're interested in. It's something they're curious about. They've got an itch they want to scratch, and that's what they go and do.
And there's one more thing that characterizes entrepreneurs. Certainly it characterized me, and I would expect it characterize you. I realized early on I never, ever wanted to work for anybody else.
Oh, my God. I was terrible at it.
I had so many jobs, short-term jobs, that I either quit or got fired from, because I just couldn't bear being told what to do.
I'm with you, brother.
So there wasn't much choice except to be an entrepreneur.
I was really fortunate in a way, and this didn't come into my consciousness really until recently, but I grew up in a family that didn't have jobs. My family was a family of shopkeepers and small business people. The people I grew up around, they had businesses, or as my grandpa would say, business. We had businesses, but they didn't really have jobs. And I didn't realize that that put a kind of an imprint on me. And for that, I'm deeply grateful. So you started off with food. That takes you to Chinese medicine. How'd the publishing come in?
Okay. So I went to acupuncture school in 1975. It was a really tough time to study acupuncture because I would say at the time there were maybe three, maybe four books in English on acupuncture total. And as you can imagine, they were pretty poor. So to study and learn was really difficult. It wasn't really till the final year that I was in college that China suddenly opened up or began to open up, and material about, you know, more reliable material about Chinese medicine started to come in. In fact, one of the treasures for us was a stack of notes of Ted Kapchuk's Chinese medicine lectures. He'd studied in Macau, so he basically studied similar syllabus to the Chinese medicine schools in Macau. He'd come back to the States and was lecturing, and of course some student naturally published the notes, and they spread
like wildfire.
Spread like wildfire. In fact, when Ted discovered that I had used them to write my final year thesis, he came to Britain. He was ready to murder me, but I soon persuaded him that it was done with the best of intentions. So after I qualified, from my entrepreneurial role in the food business, I was accustomed to the idea of having ideas and doing them. And I realized that there was this terrible, terrible lack of information on Chinese medicine in English. Even then, this was 1979, even then there was really nothing. So I decided to...
Isn't that when Eastland first published their acupuncture book?
Shanghai Comprehensive Text. Yes. Came out around then, but wonderful. You know, I loved that book. It was very pragmatic, but it has no Chinese medicine theory in it. It's a clinical book. So I decided to start a Journal of Chinese Medicine. So that was my first venture in publishing. Well, actually, that's not true. And I was, a few years before that, I published a macrobiotic cookbook. So I had little experience of writing and publishing. The journal was an attempt to fill this void, this educational void.
Yep. There's that entrepreneur again, right? There's a void. There's something I can do.
Yep. And, you know, if you look back at the early issues, we wrote articles about the most very, very basic of Chinese medicine theory and so on, because there was nowhere else to discover what wind meant or what damp meant or what yin deficiency meant or so on. So that was the first publishing venture, yeah.
You know, it's funny, when I think about publishing companies, especially like the one that you started up, especially like Eastland Press, I think about a world that didn't have the internet yet. And it was people that were gathering information, mostly because of their own interest, right? They were scratching their own itch. But it also created the material that, like, the next generation of people coming up would be able to use to learn with.
Just to give it perspective, I mean, in those early days of trying to learn Chinese medicine, we were hungry. We were really, really hungry for information. And we valued it incredibly highly. So for me personally, when I came across stuff that I thought, right, I can tell by the smell of this, the sound of it, the flavor of it, that this is the real McCoy, you know, I was ecstatic and I absorbed it. And that led to a desire to spread the information. It's the kind of opposite what happens now. If you study Chinese medicine now, you know, a bit like if you study Western medicine, you drown in books and articles and podcasts and, you know, it's overwhelming. So just a complete mirror opposite, really. So as you say, a lot of those early publishing ventures were driven by our yearning for knowledge and our desire to spread it when we found it. Yeah.
It's a curious thing to me how things run in cycles like this, right? I mean, a few minutes ago, we were talking about, like, you know, being young and, you know, a bit footloose to see what's out in the world. And then at another phase of life, you really want to consolidate things, you know, and at some point in life, you're taking in what you can get from others to, you know, to learn or to improve yourself or something. And then at another point, that comes back out. you know, is teaching or publishing, you know, helping others along. There are these cycles. I mean, we know this from Chinese medicine. There are these cycles of generation and decline. Yeah, we have the opposite problem these days. You want information about anything in Chinese medicine, just about, there's so many good resources in English. And of course, if you can read some Chinese, well, there's a treasure house that goes back thousands of years. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah. You know, in this digital age, there's no lack of information. There's an excess of information about everything. What becomes more and more important then is the filtering system.
Yes.
The quality control. I've just passed the Journal of Chinese Medicine on. So it's an X thing for me after 41, 42 years. But I'd say in the later years, we very much saw our role as being that quality control system. We'd evaluate articles and material we received. We'd decide what we felt was really valuable and worthwhile. We'd edit. What does Matt Damon say in Mars? I'm going to science the hell out of it. How are you going to survive? How are you going to survive, they say. I'm going to science the hell out of it. So we'd edit the hell out of it. You know, we'd really put a lot of work in and then go, this is what we think is the good stuff. So that role of, not gatekeeper, that sounds a bit controlling, but...
Gatekeeping is a useful function. Right. On one hand, yeah, you're using it. We're going to let these people in. We're not going to let those people in. Right. You can think about the bouncer at a club. Right. That's one kind of gatekeeper. But the other is exactly what you're talking about. It's a filter. We're going to bring in the stuff that really, you know, bring in the Jing essence of something. And we're also going to take it through a process of refinement so that it's useful and worth passing on. It's worth taking the time to read it. And it has a trustworthiness about it.
Exactly.
So you have created and successfully passed along a number of different businesses. And I love thinking about that. I certainly know earlier in my life, I was thinking, well, I got to figure out a way to make money. And as long as I'm making money, great, good for that. And then we'll let the future sort of take care of itself. But certainly as I go along in time, and especially if you create anything that has value to it, the thing takes on a life of its own. And then it's not about you. It's about that thing. You kind of need to husband it, nurture it and nourish it and make sure that it gets on its own legs.
That applies to something, certainly. So giving things up is... it's quite difficult. Letting things go is quite difficult. When I let go of my role in the food business, Infinity Foods, there was a period it was difficult and painful. When I recently let go of the journal, that was quite hard. I actually felt grief. It had been so much part of my life for, you know, decades, really, that to go, right, I'm done with that now. It's time to pass it on. That was painful. I think probably the hardest... the one that took me the longest to come around to was letting go of my Chinese medicine practice, which I gave up about roughly 10 years ago after 30 years. So that was hard. I knew it was the time to stop practicing treating patients, but it took me quite a long time to bite the bullet and accept the decision and to let go. Yeah.
Well, grief sounds appropriate. In that kind of situation, grief sounds completely appropriate. What was it that was catching your attention, especially with your acupuncture practice, that let you know, time for a change?
Well, it was a host of factors. First of all, I'd been kind of pushing myself for years. You know, I had a busy practice. I had a very busy teaching career. I was traveling all over the world. I had a family. I was editing the journal. And I just finished an 8-year project to write a manual of acupuncture, which took a lot of time. And I just joined a band. See? And
Wait a minute. That's like three different lifetimes.
Yeah, I know.
How do you pull that off?
I don't know. In a way, the band was the decider, really. I was suddenly hanging out with musicians who are a feckless lot and don't go to bed till 3 a.m. And we go off playing gigs and drive back in the middle of the night. And it kind of just triggered a few things. So one was I wanted a break from something. I wanted to let things go a bit. And somehow the practice was the one that I was most willing to let go because, to be honest, I was tired of it. There's an English word, I don't know if you're familiar with it, vocation. We talk about vocation for the church. We used to talk about vocation for the church or vocation for medicine. Now, I have friends and colleagues who have a vocation for medicine and will practice medicine probably till their last breath. It's utterly natural for them. I actually went into Chinese medicine primarily because I loved the philosophy, the theory. I loved learning Chinese medicine. It was almost a surprise to me when I finished studying that I was suddenly sitting in a room all day treating sick people. I'd almost forgotten that that's what it involved.
Yeah. Oh, and how did I get here?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I loved it. Don't get me wrong. I pretty much loved everything about it. But it got to the point when I suddenly found myself, I don't want to shock you, but somebody would start telling me their problem. And they'd start telling me about their hip pain. And I'd be asking the same questions. Oh, where do you feel it? And when is it worse? And when is it better? And so on. And there'd be a voice inside my head going, I don't want to listen to this anymore. I just, I've run out of compassion for these kind of issues. What I see looking back now, because I talked about letting go of things, even precious things, and about the empty space it creates, but then trusting the process, something arises in the empty space. So in the empty space, after I stopped practicing, I discovered that actually I was much more interested in health education in Yangsheng, not in, as the Neijing says, not in treating disease after it's arisen, but helping prevent it in the first place. So that is like a lot of things came together. By that time, I was doing a lot of Qigong. I was still very passionate about the healthy, transformative effect of good diet. I'd gone through a concentrated period of therapy, so I understood much more about the impact of our emotional state on our health and well-being. These were the things I was more interested in. So I slowly stopped, after I stopped practicing, I spent, alongside my rock and roll career, I started studying, and because I was already still teaching a lot, I started to teach less acupuncture. I felt increasingly it's not right to teach acupuncture once I stopped practicing. It's a disconnect.
It sounds like you've always fueled yourself on a sense of authentic inquiry.
Yeah, authentic is a word it's really important to me. So I started to think more about Yangsheng, nourishment of life. I started to read more, study more. I started to teach. Initially, it was like, oh, here's a one-hour lecture on Yangsheng. Then it grew to half a day. Then it grew to a day. Then it grew to a whole weekend or even a three-day workshop because I was just accumulating information all the time and drawing on my own experience. And then I reached the point, I thought, well, there's a book here, which was tentative for a while. The way it happened is I did a two-year creative writing course at my local university. So I started writing a lot of fiction. I wrote a lot of short stories. And then I wrote a novel, a young adult novel, which I was quite excited about. That took me about a year to write. And I finished the novel and I just knew there was something not quite right with it. I finally found the person. Took me a while, the person who could tell me what was wrong with it. And it required a big change. And that kind of knocked me back. So rather than tackle the big, complete rewrite of this novel, I did a displacement activity and decided to write the Yangsheng book. So it's kind of, it's almost like an avoidance of going back to my novel, was to write this book called Live Well, Live Long. But don't get me wrong, I mean, I was passionate about writing it and I loved the whole process. I mean, it meant, for example, that I could go to the wonderful British Library. I don't know whether you have anything equivalent. You're in the States, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So the British Library is a wonderful institution that somehow they've not managed to kill in the years of austerity. If once you get a reader's card, you can request, you go online now, you request any book that's ever been published in the English language. And you can turn up at the library a couple of days later. You can order up to a dozen books. Go to one of the old reading rooms.
Yeah. Oh, the old reading rooms.
And they just say, here are your books, sir. So I was able to, you know, I don't read Chinese, but I was able to research, you know, everything that had been written in English on Yangsheng, on Taoist lifestyle, on and so on. Plus, what was really important to me was to also investigate Yangsheng from the scientific perspective. Because I find a lot of New Age thinking, I find a lot of ungrounded acupuncture thinking very frustrating because it's unquestioned, it's not rooted, it's fanciful often, it's fake news. excuse the term, especially a lot of New Age thinking. So I felt it was really important both to...
Well, it's believing some story in your head and you're looking for a confirmation bias that what I want to be true is true, which gets us into all kinds of trouble eventually.
Well, we know we can see that going on, unfolding at this very moment in politics, both in the United States and in my country.
You know? Or even just in what people decide they're going to eat.
Yep.
Fad diets. I mean, there's all kinds of things.
I mean, you know, it's a slight digression, but I was initially very shocked. Now I've become very despondent about how the world of complementary medicine, some, a surprising number of people in the world of complementary medicine and what we loosely call the New Age have signed up to and promoted conspiracy theories about all kinds of things. They've allied themselves with the far right in a lot of their political attitudes and so on. I'm desperately sad about that. So anyway, coming back to the book, I was really keen both that what I wrote about the Chinese health tradition was accurate, it reflected what was actually said and written, and that we could look at that through the lens of modern lifestyle research and just evaluate it. And of course, what was exciting and remarkable and no surprise to me was how far ahead of the time, how far ahead of its time the Chinese tradition was, and how the Western lifestyle science is an infant, really. It's in its infancy compared to that tradition.
So you scienced the hell out of it.
Wow. I haven't got a science background. I did my best. Yeah.
Science. No, but I mean, just taking that perspective of, and this is what I love about science. This is one of the things I truly love about science. Number one, it's based on observation. You start with observation, what's happening in the world. Number two, you come up with some ideas about what does that mean and what might that mean. And then you go and you test it. And I think the true scientist is every bit as happy to get a no as a yes to their idea, because it's not about attachment to the results. It's about the inquiry. And then it takes something. It takes the fortitude. And we deal with this all the time in clinic when things don't go well. The fortitude to go, that was a good idea, not proven out by reality. I was wrong. what might that mean, and now what? And how you hang in that kind of empty space of, oh, I'm back to uncertainty and not knowing.
Well, those words you just uttered could have been spoken by me word for word. I completely agree with you. I'd add two things to it. One is that the Taoists were scientists in the sense that they observed nature without preconceived beliefs. If you compare that to religion, which was very, very, very slow to accommodate science because it didn't align with their preconceived beliefs. You know, Galileo was nearly executed. The Taoists observed without a belief system, and according, not everybody agrees, but according to the great sinologist, Joseph Needham, that's a big contributor to why early Chinese science was the most advanced in the world at its time. Early Chinese astronomy, mechanics, physics, and medicine, and inventions, sometimes hundreds, sometimes even thousands of years before the West. So that's, we come from a tradition of scientists, our medicine. And the second thing is this wonderful thing that, as you said, a scientist is as happy to be almost as happy to be proved wrong as to be proved right, because what they're passionate about is finding truth. That lesson, tough as it may be, can apply to our whole lives. Every attitude we have, every belief we have to be willing to change and adapt in the light of new information. That makes life an adventure. And to me, that's part of Yangcheng, because the essence, one of the strands of Yangcheng is change and adaptability, going with the flow. When we become stuck physically, mentally, emotionally, that starts to kill us. That's the, you know, the partner of death, as the Tao Te Ching would say. Flexibility, softness, that's the partner of life. So the art of, you know, Yangcheng, of course, is interested in successful aging. The art of successful aging is to be willing to change all the time. And as soon as we become stagnant, then we decline.
Reishi is a precious medicinal. The ancient Chinese herbalist Shennong classified reishi or lingzhi as a superior herb safe for prolonged consumption. In addition to preventing and treating illness, this mushroom is said to even cultivate a person's virtue. Today, we know that reishi is a powerful adaptogen, meaning that this fantastic fungi helps the body skillfully deal with stress. Furthermore, reishi is non-toxic and it can be taken consistently over long periods of time. It can normalize both physical and psychological health, which translates as clarity and energy in the daytime and the ability to sleep restfully at night. Here's a pro tip. Quality reishi is bitter as it's rich in triterpenes, which are plant antioxidants. So put your palate to work and taste the delicious bitter flavor of Real Mushrooms reishi. Real Mushrooms is 100% real mushrooms, pure and simple, all organic and no grain filler. Get wholesale access to Real Mushrooms by texting Pro Pricing, all one word, to the number 33777.
So you bring up something that for me is very poignant, which is we all have these belief systems. We all have these stories. We got this idea how the universe works, often because it got us to where we are. We've survived with a certain story. But most solutions we find in life contain the seed of our next big problem, which is why we're constantly going through these evolutions and we're constantly changing. And having to come to this place, and we've touched on it a couple of times in this conversation. I think about you in that reading room at the library with these books. That's a big, empty space. And we come to these places in our life where we're between, we're like a belief system is kind of unraveling. I'm curious to know how you recognize that you're at one of those moments where the beliefs and the ideas and the structures that have gotten you to where you are aren't going to get you to where you're going next. And now you're in that space of uncertainty that you've talked about. That can be so uncomfortable. And I suspect you were just saying it's a part of Yangsheng to be able to create that space in the body and then something arises. But it's that creating that space, I think, is a huge challenge for most of us.
Yeah, but let's remind ourselves of the yin and yang of it, because I would also say that there are fundamentals in my life that I am sure of. There are basic fundamentals that I know about myself and about life that I don't feel the need to change. I mean, I love practicing Qigong. How I practice it might change. You know, I might adapt and go, oh, that's not what I want to do anymore. I want to do it this way. But Qigong is fundamental to me. Being in nature is fundamental. Growing vegetables is fundamental. Listening to music is fundamental. Building and maintaining friendships is fundamental. Laughing. I don't really have doubt about those. The rest of the stuff, that's all right. But, I suppose along with being willing to be flexible and adaptable and change, we also do build, as long as we've lived like that, we build wisdom. You know, I'm in my 70s now. I do treasure that. I feel the things I feel and know about life that have come from that process. And now they're kind of fairly solid. So it's a combination of keeping. It's a bit like, I'll tell you what it's like. In Qigong, we sometimes say, lower body like a mountain, upper body like a cloud. We build a foundation, a strong foundation, and the cloud can waft and flow over the mountaintop in a soft and flexible way. So it's yin and yang. So I'd see it like that rather than suggesting that everything is constantly in upheaval and everything is unanchored. I don't feel that.
Everything is change. There absolutely is that. But hearing you, it's not a but, it's an and. And hearing you talk about that there are certain fundamentals and you know they're true, they're root, they're core. There's something unchanging within the world of change. It's something, I'm going to call it of essence.
Yep.
It's knowing your essence.
Yeah. And that essence, it's partly fundamental and it's partly unique to each individual, their essence.
And when you know what your essence is, you've got that solid mountain.
Yep.
That does take time though, doesn't it?
It does take time, but I mean, how boring it would be to reach that point at the age of 20. I mean, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? No, I'm exaggerating. Some people discover exactly what they appear to be put on this planet for at a very young age and just carry on in exactly that way, often to the benefit of humanity. So yeah.
I've got a younger brother who's a musician. He's a professional musician. He knew at like the age of 11.
Yeah.
It's like, that's what I'm doing. And my mom would be like, don't you think you might want to like learn accounting or something just in case? He's like, no.
I just watched a series on Netflix that I love called The Queen's Gambit. I don't know if you've come across that.
You're the second person to mention it in the space of about 2 weeks.
Okay. Well, I really, 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 really enjoyed it. It's about chess. I don't play chess. I don't really know much about chess at all. But it is an example of somebody who at a very, very young age, it's almost like she was born with chess ingrained in her. It's fiction, but of course we know this does happen. We know people like this. So I think that's why it's part one of the reasons such a compelling story. Going back to the Yangsheng, you know, in the Chinese tradition, there's a lot within the Yangsheng and within the medicine, there's a lot of weird and mystical and wacky stuff. Even take somebody like Sun Tzu Miao, you know, for all his incredible down-to-earth wisdom about the basics of life, there's also, you know, I think it's him who said, you know, if a woman is in delayed labor, burn the underpants and pubic hair of the father of the child and feed it to her as a medicine. I'm not really into that, you know, or don't cut your toenails on a Wednesday when the moon is rising in the east or whatever. I believe that fundamentally, Yangsheng, the teachings of how to live a healthy, happy, and as long as possible human life are really very basic. They're real common sense. And they have an immense amount to offer the world, especially when health advice is so, you know, with the internet, as you mentioned about diet, it's so confusing to people with so many different arguments and takes and beliefs and so on, that to have the kind of common sense and time-tested understanding of this incredible 2,500-year tradition, it's a real treasure. And it's something that I feel our profession, I almost feel it's the, well, I don't have to feel it. It's what the Nei Jing said. It's the highest level of the Chinese medicine profession, actually, is not the treatment of disease, however wonderful that is, but it's the teaching of how to live that's wonderful. So that was the thinking behind the book. And, you know, I'd love it if I could wave my magic wand. Every Chinese medicine clinic would be an education center as much as it is a treatment center.
What would you teach at that education center? What would that look like?
I actually set up a natural health education center nearly 40 years ago, Brighton Natural Health Center, which, you know, from the very early days was teaching yoga, tai chi, meditation, diet. So it would be like that. It would invite patients to come to sessions where those things were taught, those things were discussed. I mean, some of it, it's so tragically obvious. There was a general practice, a Western medical general practice in Britain that decided to start a walking group for its diabetes patients. Every day, half an hour walk. Somebody led it. They evaluated the results after a month. The benefits from simply not just walking, but of being outside, walking through the park, seeing trees, being in nature, and being in a social group. The results were so dramatic in terms of reduction in medication and improvement in health status and improvement in quality of life. If you could have put that in a pill, you know, it would have made $100 billion. So interventions don't have to be complex. They can be very simple. Easing people towards better diet, easing people towards more movement, easing people towards methods of gaining some control over chaotic emotional states. These can be, the effects can be so dramatic.
I'm just thinking, and maybe because I'm an American and we tend to do things in extreme. We're all about extremes. I hear you use the words easing people towards. Easing them towards food, easing them towards movement, easing them towards healthy social interactions. We don't often think about the word ease in terms of something that's worthwhile, useful, helpful, and good for your health. I'm really struck by listening to you in this moment of how most people, I think, at least in my country, would take the idea of, well, you know, let's just ease you from this to that. I don't know if that's going to be an easy sell. I mean, I listen to it and I go, wow, thank you. Oh, the pressure's off.
Well, maybe I can just mention the latest project that I'm working on because it's very much exactly in this field. So I've been working with a couple of colleagues on an app. It's based on the original.
You're an entrepreneur. Look at you.
Yeah, I know.
It's just the next. It's the next level of publishing.
I did say to the guy who proposed it to me, "No, I'm done with projects." But I realized it was something that I really feel very passionate about. So it was based on the person who my friend Tom told me about a physiotherapist's app. So. I don't know if you do you have physiotherapists in the state?
Oh, yes.
Physical therapists. Yeah.
Yes, we do.
So it's so backward. It used to be so, well, it is still so backward in Britain. You'd go with a problem and they'd give you a 50 times photocopied sheet of line drawings of exercises to do in a rubber band, and that go away and do this. So somebody developed an app where they made like 100, 150 videos of exercises. And the patient could download a free version of the app and the physiotherapist could prescribe 5 videos. And so do these, do them every day, record when you've done them. So we've taken that with Yang Sheng and we've created videos and audios of Qigong movements, self-massage, self-acupressure, meditation, diet recipes for different TCM patterns. So it's like a library of, short health practices.
Mm-hmm. And so it's interactive.
Well, what it is that the practitioner will pay to have access to this, small monthly fee. The patient will download the free version of the app and the practitioner can say, look, I want you to do these exercises 5 times a day, Here are some changes to diet you could try, some recipes. You can do these recipes. You can, you've got a shoulder problem. Here's some self-massage you can do and so on. So it's to help practitioners offer health advice to patients. Can I mention the name of it?
No, please. Yeah, this sounds like a fantastic resource. Please let us know. Yeah, no, let us know all about this.
So it's the app. We've got a website now already. It's not quite launched, the app. The website is called Jing, J-I-N-G, jingselfcare.com. So people can already go to the website. They can look at some of the material that we've got and they can sign up to be informed when the app is up and running. We think it takes lots of boxes because apart from anything else, busy practitioners don't have time necessary or even have the expertise to show whatever it is, Qigong practice for calming the mind or for developing healthy hips or, all these kinds of things.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. I'll make sure that link is on the show notes page. So all y'all's listening to this right now, you could just go right to the show notes page and click on that. I love this idea, Peter, and I know that I have spent way too much time in my clinic trying to teach people certain movements. Sometimes it's helpful, but then they get home and they don't remember or they just forget to do it. I mean, the nice thing about an app, it'll probably have a little reminder on there. Hey, exactly. Time to do your... Yeah.
Exactly. And and congratulations.
Yeah, like a wife in it, right? It's like my wife is nagging me all the time. Do this, do that, right?
Yeah.
So it like comes in with a built-in Chinese wife. So that'd be nice.
Well, I don't, we don't want to nag people. Just a reminder. And then maybe a pat on the back. Oh, you've done your exercises 7 times this week. Well done. You get a gold star,
Yes, people well, like, I take people the nagging like that somebody loves me.
Yeah. Exactly. So it's a sign the practitioner, and it comes from the practitioner, and the practitioner can put their own name on the app and they can put their own details. So it also acts as promotion for the practitioner.
That sounds really, really helpful. That sounds super helpful. In my practice, there's a few things that I've found I used to say to patients all the time, and over time I've learned to automate some of those into like little audio courses and things. So I can just say, hey, look, rather than spend the next 20 minutes talking to you about this, just go to my website and it's right here. So that sounds like a fantastic resource. When do you think it'll launch? Do you have a...
Well, unfortunately, we heard that it's pretty nearly finished, but the developer who's doing the kind of tech development in Pakistan is down with COVID. So we're not quite sure how ill he is, how sick he is, and how much that affects the development. I mean, it is a small company, so they'll probably find somebody else. So we were going to say, you know, we would have been able to say it'll be launched in about 3 weeks. So there's some slight uncertainty about that at the moment.
Yep. All right. Well, people can go to the website and get some updates. That sounds fantastic. Do you have other projects going on besides this? This is the main thing at this moment.
Well, the project that I've just nearly completed, I mentioned, is I have written my memoirs and sort of connected in or shoehorned in a stack of short stories. So it's a combination of memoirs and short stories that I'm due to publish. And the because it's a bit of a narcissistic project to write about me, I'm going to sell it. There's an ebook, and I'm going to donate the profits to, I set up with some other friends, I set up a charity for a tree planting charity.
I wanted to ask you about that. I'm glad that you bring it up because I've seen that you have this forestry project.
Yeah, it's called the Chinese Medicine Forestry Trust. It was a response of four friends last year who we were all sharing this feeling of being overwhelmed by the constant news of the degradation of the planet. You know, this awful news about environmental collapse, species extinction, the pollution of seas, climate change, just despair and grief, really. One antidote to those feelings is to pick something and act, to do something positive, both for our own mental health and for its effects. So we all love trees, so we decided we'd set up this charitable trust that seeks to draw in money from the global Chinese medicine community and just funnel it straight into three international organizations that are planting trees and protecting forests right through the world. So it's very, very simple. There's nothing complex about it. So that's, it's a constant appeal to Chinese medicine businesses, practitioners, students to just chip in with a bit of money. And in the knowledge that, you know, if you donate $10 a month, you can go to bed knowing that every month you're planting 10 trees. It's kind of a remarkable feeling, really.
Doing what you can to help?
Yeah, doing what you can to help. Because planting trees is a kind of win-win-win thing to do. It ticks many boxes, you know.
And it's truly something that we do not do for ourselves. We do it for our children, and we do it for our children's children. I mean, the act of planting a tree is probably one of the most generous things I think that anybody can do in this world.
Yeah. And of course, that's abstract. I mean, last year I planted a small plum tree in my garden, and I can't tell you how damn good I feel about it. I mean, to planting your own tree, if you have a chance, is just incredible. So
I'm looking out at a Japanese maple that I put in this past summer. It sits right outside my window here, and I get to like watch it through the seasons.
So is it in a pot or in the earth?
It's in the earth.
Okay, because I planted one in a pot. It will go into the earth eventually, but yeah. That's great.
Wonderful. I will make sure that a link to that is up on the show notes page as well.
Thank you.
So people can check that. Thank you. Thanks for this time today. Thank you for all of your curiosity and all the nudges that you followed. You're a person who's made our medicine, helped to make our medicine rich and helped to make it accessible to so many people. You know, and when you started out, there weren't that many people that were doing this. And, the work that you've done has helped generations of people now.
It's nice to hear you say that. Thank you. Yep.
Before we wind this down, is there anything else that you'd like to share with us about Yangsheng or medicine or just anything that's on your mind?
Well, the only thing that pops up, I didn't have anything really, is that when we want to take care of ourselves, particularly we've been sick, we have to be a bit committed and we have to be a bit serious. But remember that another part of Yangsheng is laughter, fun, love, parties, dancing. We mustn't get too serious. Balance, you know, that's something really important to me. So that's probably the last thing I'd say, apart from thank you for the opportunity and thank you for what you're doing. You've obviously built up quite a library of these talks, and that's a wonderful resource.
I'm a bit like you in that way. I got a hunch one day, and I was just curious to see where it would go. I've been very surprised to see where it's gone. I've been immensely grateful that I've had this opportunity that I can sit down with so many people, from people that are well-known to people that no one has ever heard of because they're just busy being, you know, the crafts person that they are in their clinic.
They're a treasure. Those people are a great treasure.
Such a treasure. Yeah. And I feel so fortunate that I'm living in a time where we can have things like podcasts that makes it easy. It's like, you're a writer, so you know this. Writing a story is hard. It takes time. It takes effort. It takes sweat. It's not easy, but sitting down and having a conversation, well, you know, we're social animals and we do that as naturally as drinking a cup of tea. And so I'm deeply grateful to the technology that is here at this time because it helps us to connect the voices of our community in a way that before you had to be literate, you had to be able to read and you had to have the initiative to be able to write. And so this audio thing opens up a whole different domain. I've been lucky to be able to have my curiosity lead me here. So thanks for joining me today, and thank you for bringing Jing to us. I'm looking forward to getting it on my phone.
Great.
Can't wait to see it.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Peter.
Bye-bye now.
It seems to me that generativity, creating something that has not previously existed, doing something that you see as repairing a hole in the world, is both a generous and a courageous act. We can never know in advance if our efforts will pay off. We find many ways of doing it wrong on the way to getting it right. But, like with any practice, persistence, patience, and a willingness to learn as we go can, over the course of decades, change the trajectory of lives. Speaking of relentless persistence, next week, tune in for a conversation with Sabina Vilms on the celestial secrets from the Tanya Jing. Sabina, if you're not familiar with her, is a prolific translator of old medicine, and in our conversation, we'll be tracking the mythic Tanya Jing through history and a dusty manuscript from Dunhuang. Tune in then for this exciting geological conversation.